You're now listening to The Brian Callen Show with your host, Brian Callen.
All right, guys, guess what? I have to interrupt because I am going to do an advertisement. We'll get right back to the show. I just have to talk about DraftKings.com. Fantasy baseball fans, on opening day, DraftKings.com awarded over $500,000 in cash prizes. See, it's one thing to play a game. It's another thing to play for cash. It's a lot more exciting, I think. All right? Now, you got to check out DraftKings.com. Okay, it's the one-day fantasy sports site, all right? And it is a fact that the listeners have won hundreds, thousands, even $1 million, not my listeners, but listeners in general, with DraftKings, okay? You watch sports and play fantasy, okay? This guy named Sam, don't know anything else about him, he won $100,000, apparently, his first time ever playing. So there is real money to be won. So here's the bottom line. Right now, you can play for free. You can win real cash. Enter Callen, C-A-L-L-E-N, today at DraftKings.com and get free entry into another huge contest. And they are awarding over $400,000 in cash prizes. $400,000. All right? That's what I make like a week. So that's a lot of money, guys. All right. Well, listen. Enter Callen now at DraftKings.com. All right? You get to play for free and win real cash. What more do you want from me? Oh, I know. The podcast. Let's get back to it, shall we? About that. I didn't expect that. Ladies and gentlemen, a man who speaks 50 languages extremely badly, Bert Vaux, is our guest. He is a linguist professor. He's a professor of linguistics at Harvard University and Cambridge University. I don't know if you guys have ever heard of those two learning institutions, but they have big buildings that have been there a long time. And I'm pleased to welcome Mr. Bert Vaux, ladies and gentlemen. I don't know. I've never done that before. Yay! Bert's 6'6", and he played two sports. So he's not just a nerd. He's an athlete, and he's blonde, and he's wearing. You're wearing. You look like I said. You look a little bit like a J. Crew model. So congratulations on all counts, sir. Well done.
And he's welcome. Also a musician.
Are you a musician? Really? Are
a
you
a rock
really?
Star?
What do you play?
I used to play in a few bands.
Unbelievable.
Yeah.
Unbelievable.
Right?
6'6", and he played baseball and basketball in college, and he played... What instrument do you play?
Mainly guitar.
All right, this podcast this podcast is over. I feel bad about myself.
And he speaks 50 languages extremely badly.
What are the languages... Now, let's talk for a second about... I'm actually really excited to have you on, because one of the things that we know is people have accents, and they have regional accents. So In London, for example, just London proper, I think there's something crazy like 15 different accents. East London sounds different than West London, North London. And I don't know if I'm right even on the 15. I'm sure there are even more. And then if you look at the entire country, the Great Britain at least, the mainland, there are, it's all over the map. Then if you look [S2] Yep. [S1] At this country, you've got New England, and then you've got the South. And what I've always been fascinated with is the fact that accents are so resilient. And why does somebody from Alabama talk like this? And why does somebody from New York talk like this? And from Boston or wherever you're from, there are these things that not only are very different, but seem to have resilience. They just get passed down from generation to generation.
Yeah, I think there are two main factors. One is that you're not handed your language by your parents via electronic cable or anything. You have to figure out how your language works by hearing it around you as you're a little kid. And you only hear a small percentage of the total range of possibilities in the language. So we actually have to guess and fill in most of how the language works.
Huh.
And by this process, a lot of things that are non-standard sneak in. And the other component that enables specific regional patterns to survive and even to expand is humans don't like being identical to each other. They tend to like to be like a few people they look up to, typically kids 1 year older than them.
It makes total sense. Yeah.
Yeah. There are also groups they don't want to sound like their parents and grandparents and like rival cliques in their school. And taking on
rival cliques is how I say it. Keep going. He says cliques because he's from Harvard. And, sorry to interrupt.
taking on non-standard features, like, say, features of a Boston accent, would set you apart from the standard people like the teachers and the principal and so on that you don't want to sound like.
Wow. That's amazing.
Yeah, it's ultimately so much of language and dialect is about identity, right?
Yeah,
you know,
exactly.
And that's like even George W. Bush is a fascinating one because, you know, the guy's from Connecticut, right? But he wants to mark himself out as a Texan, and he does it by speaking with a Texan accent that he deliberately
acquires.
I didn't know.
For some reason I forgot that he was actually from Connecticut.
Yeah.
I always thought he was from Texas.
It's doubly fake because he's sort of from Houston, which, you know, is the oil capital of Texas.
Yeah.
That's where I grew up. And Houstonians, because they mainly came from the south, from the north, I mean, for the oil industry, they don't have classic Texan accents normally. So his is doubly put on because it's not a real Texas accent and it's not a fake real Texas accent either.
Yeah. Well, you know, I do accents sometimes in my act, and I've always, you know, I grew up all over the world, and I've always been acutely aware, for example, of one of the jokes I used to do is, you know, if you are from Italy, it sounds more, you know, soft, more like more romantic or something like that. But if you are from Lebanon, it's more aggressive, Yanni. I don't know. I want to take you to my bed, make you very nice, like that. And there's a very subtle difference there. But one is harder and the other is softer, you know, so to speak. I mean, I wonder if why it seems that some cultures, I mean, if you listen to the way Japanese is spoken, for example, at least in the traditional samurai, you know, if you listen to the difference between men and women, men talk more. I mean, I'm being very stereotypical, but it's true in movies where it's like, harashiro, you know, whatever. And the women are like, I don't know, and they whisper it. But those seem to be real. I mean, even though they're stereotypical, there is some truth to that stuff, right?
Oh, yeah, definitely. Men and women speak noticeably differently in every culture and every subculture. That fits in with that scheme I mentioned before, where people are interested in sounding like one group and specifically not sounding like other groups in opposition to them. But with Japan, you've picked a particularly good case because there are actually grammatical differences between the Japanese used by men and used by women.
Mm.
And that gets subverted in high schools traditionally. There's this group called Kogyaru, which are cool girls, where they specifically take on features of the male Japanese speech variety and use them to subvert the normal gender patterns in their school.
Wow.
And Bert, I remember one of your students at Harvard wrote a whole thing about gay speech.
Oh, yeah. That's a hot topic these days. One of my last students at Harvard, Mike Schuler, did his whole thesis on whether undergraduates could identify the sexual orientation of male undergraduates just from their speech. Mm. And they were extremely accurate at that.
Wow. I guess we all take on the way we speak is, it feels like, you're right, it is identity. I remember when I was a young guy and having grown up all over the world, and I don't know if you can tell because I have such an aristocratic bearing, but I did grow up in a lot of different countries, so I've always thought of my accent as fairly neutral. I don't know how you feel about it.
Yeah,
would you say that's correct?
Yeah, you're like Hunter. You both have what non-linguists would label as a standard American accent.
Yeah,
and what I've actually worked on most in my career is figuring out where people like you are from by having just the right subtle questions to ask.
Really? And what were the questions? I mean, do you need more time with it's hard. It takes a while to get over the timbre in my voice. It's very hypnotic. It tends to relax you.
There are people who can actually tell almost immediately by timbre and things like that, the Henry Higgins sort. My variety depends on vocabulary mainly.
Mm.
And it tends to be things where people don't realize that the words they're using are not standard. And so they don't assimilate them into the standard when they're being assimilated like you and Hunter were in high school.
And even the first time I ever met Bert, you know, Bert was an awesome professor. Like, I actually ran for student president just basically because I thought we need more professors like Bert who actually cared
about us.
And I lost. I lost in a flaming ball of glory.
You ran for student president at Harvard.
Because teaching...
Because you wanted to improve their
I wanted to improve
staff.
Teaching because
that's
the,
impressive.
They have... They
that's
have,
impressive.
No, but they have really, they basically select faculty based on how impressive their resumes are in terms of research. But there's almost no focus on teaching at a lot of the lead institutions. Like, most of the teachers just don't care. Mm-hmm. Like, they're just, you know, passing time until they can get back into the lab.
Right.
But Bert was awesome. And really, I mean, you know, I had put on my application that I was interested in potentially taking linguistics. And Bert met with every single student who had declared that as a possible major.
Wow.
Which just...
Well, what makes you so... We'll get back to this stuff. But why linguistics? What got you so interested in it? I mean, I understand as I talk to you. I mean, but what is, from your words? I mean,
there are two things just in the development of me as a person growing up in Texas. I was exposed to Spanish and English. And then we moved to Germany. So I was exposed to German. And then I started French and Latin when I was in seventh grade, and they all fascinated me, and I wanted to be able to interact with people from those cultures. I think probably because of my borderline autism, I always found it hard to interact with English speakers, and I was hoping that by learning these other languages, it'd become easier to interact with people from those cultures. That was a dismal failure in the end, but...
I love that you say you have borderline autism. That's fantastic. That's actually very romantic to me. He plays music and he's an athlete and he's 6'6". And by the way, he's borderline autistic and a Harvard Cambridge professor.
Most professors are, I would say. Would you agree, Hunter?
Well, you know.
Most what are?
Yeah, whether it's autism or just incredibly introverted and they feel more comfortable in the lab. I mean, that's part of the reason why I left science. I mean, I thought the culture was nuts. Like, these people, I mean, the lab that I was in, we had there was a postdoc and then there was the PI, basically the head of the lab, the boss. They had not spoken in a year. Like, literally had not exchanged two words.
Wow.
The PI would come into the lab and the postdoc would leave. The postdoc would
were
come
they
into the lab.
In a fight or are they just...
Well, they just, like, that's the point, is that, you know, this is supposedly, like, your boss, the guy who's supposed to be mentoring you, and their relation, and this is supposed to be his number one student, and their relationship was so bad that for a year they had not
I don't
spoken.
Have the energy. I can't stay
yeah.
mad. But, you know, what I was talking about before we got off the topic was I remember... Coming to New York, my family was from New York, but I'd grown up all over the world. I had nothing to root me. I was from everywhere. And but then I saw Robert De Niro in Mean Streets and in Raging Bull. And then I saw Christopher Walken in several movies. And then I saw Al Pacino, and I wanted to be an actor. And I realized I was half Italian, and my mother was Sicilian from Brooklyn. And my grandfather talked like this from, you know, they were all educated, but at the end of the day, this is how I decided I wanted to sound. I was, you know, I had a little bit of my New York and a little bit, you know. And then, of course, I realized that, you know, when you're in an audition, you gotta be careful with some of it. But I thought this sound made me sound edgy, somewhat tough, and like I was from New York.
Yep.
And it was very sad. It was very sad, but and it didn't work out as for acting. But in fact, I remember several auditions. They were like, "Can you be less New York? Because what is going on here?" And I go, "Oh yeah, sure, no problem. Here I am."
Yeah.
So yeah, I think that people do take on accents and they do take on things. Just it's a form of identity, isn't it?
Oh yeah, definitely.
And when
what you're describing, we call covert prestige. It's a phenomenon where a non-standard variety of speech has associations of coolness and toughness and so on. And it tends to be more working class males who are drawn to that sort of thing.
Yeah, well, the Brits do the same thing. I know if you speak the Queen's English, you'll see a lot of young Londoners. They throw in a lot of Cockney in there as well.
Yeah.
I mean, they've got that sort of thing.
Yeah, well, I mean, I went to Eton, which is, I mean, the most snobby, prestigious, like, I mean, you know, everybody is like the
High
Duke
tea.
Of this. Yeah, exactly. And they would all insist upon walking around and going, "Oh, then, how you doing, mate? Yeah."
Yeah.
And it's so ridiculous because it's, you know, the Duke of Richmond who is talking that way.
Yeah.
And you're like, dude, you're not fooling anyone.
You know what that's called, Hunter?
What, Bert?
It starts with an M.
Bert likes to quiz his students.
Hold on.
Off me.
Mofney?
Yeah. Mockney.
That's
there you go. So
yeah, because the real what I love to do when I go to London is talk to the cab drivers, and they've got this sort of really strong Cockney. I mean, I couldn't have said it better myself. I'll tell you right now. And you're like, and then they have the rhyming. It's unbelievable, man. And my buddy Tony Jeffries, who's a boxer, and I go in there and try to pretend. It makes me, again, I like to look tough, so I like to get in there and swing at the air and then wheeze and, you know, and pretend I'm actually boxing. It's so sad again. But he's from the north, near Liverpool. That's a whole different ballgame, man.
Yeah.
That's a macho culture, by the way. You can get in a fight right quick in one of those bars up there in like Manchester and all that area.
Yeah, yeah, the old northern industrial cities. Yeah. They have a lot of Irish influence in those old coastal cities, and then they also actually are much more conservative than the other English kinds of English. In the southeast of England, around London, a lot of changes have happened since the 17th century. But once you get up to Manchester and north of that, they have most of the old pronunciation still.
Mm. Why? Is it a form of holding on to their independence?
That's a very difficult question to answer.
Yeah.
It's hard to predict when one group will conserve something and another won't. We're sort of stuck there.
Why in the world do people... Why did the people from the South, considering a lot of people came through Brooklyn, I mean, Ellis Island, but I mean, also just, you know, I think the first people that came, the biggest waves were Irish and German initially. Why in the world are people from, you know, the South, why do they have a Southern accent? And why do people from the North not, quote unquote, have a Southern accent? Well, how did that happen?
That's a really good question. So the base of the Southern accents of American English is the Jamestown colony. It was created by Walter Raleigh and other people from the southwest of England. So they brought their speech patterns from the southwest of England, which included pronouncing all the R's, like they still do in Devon and Somerset and so on today.
So give me an example.
Like saying pirate English. If you think of that, that is Cornwall, Devon English. So we'll say R.
Oh.
There's a farmer there.
Jeremy Timber.
A farmer there. So the way, almost the way, well, Johnny Depp didn't really speak that way in the movie. I'm trying.
Yeah, that's Keith Richards English.
Right. But that's Irish. I can see Irish. The Irish is about. Okay.
Yep, they're also rhotic. So the South was settled originally by English speakers from that part of England, and they brought their patterns with them. And then the next wave was people who came from around London and Cambridge who were not rhotic, so they didn't pronounce all the R's. And they went to the Boston area. And so there you get people who say Bath and Kant and so on, just around London. And then the third way was the one you mentioned, the Scots, Irish, and Germans who came into Philadelphia in the 18th century. And then they spread westward through the country from there. And so you get features from the north of England and Scotland and Ireland and in the Midlands, as we call it.
So their language, whether it was German or whatever, I guess it sort of got distilled into this sort of this thing that we all talk. I mean, one of the things I will say, I wonder, and I wanted to talk about this, is when you have a group of friends that get together. I have a podcast called the 10-Minute Podcast, and we started doing these things where we have a bit of a following, and we started doing things like, well, instead of saying I am, we'd go, well, instead of saying I'm a dancer, we'd go, I'm a dancer, and so cute. Instead of I'm so cute, so cute. And we just kept doing those kinds of things, and it just caught on. And one of the things I notice is men, when they get together, they create their own language. If you heard me and my buddies I've known for 20 years in New York talking, it would be there is a whole code. There is a whole language that we kind of, you know, we there are these, I don't know what the word is, but for example, a lot of times we'll be like, well, by the way, and by the way, if I may, you know, hold that thought, hold, if I may. And then we all talk the same. And usually it starts with one sharp profile in the group, somebody who's good with that stuff, who can manipulate language. And boy, does it have resilience. It's a kind of a bonding factor.
Mm-hmm.
I've been talking a lot.
Yeah, you summed up an excellent example of what we were talking about before. So you have the creativity of your little group, which sets you apart from everyone else and establishes you as having a coherent bond within yourselves, mm. while also separating you from the people you don't want to be like, who say I'm instead of mm.
So in other words, human beings are tribal.
Yeah.
And part of being tribal is creating your own sounds.
Yeah. Humans and I would say primates in general, or many of the primates, are highly creative. And you need that for language to evolve, in fact, that initial creative urge that generates variation in the population.
Are we evolving in language, or are we, I mean, Shakespeare,
yes.
Shakespeare came along a long time ago. And I don't know that we've improved on his words, but.
Well, evolution doesn't mean improvement. It just means change.
Okay.
And one of the biggest changes is the tendency towards simplification, right? Users tend to simplify their language and make it easier and easier to speak, right?
Languages can simplify along one dimension, like, say, losing word endings like English. English used to mark gender on nouns like, say, Spanish or French do, but we lost that in the Middle English period. Mm. So that's a simplification we've had. But that can then lead to complexification in other areas. So once we lost the endings on words that told you what is a subject and what is the object of a sentence, we then developed fixed word order. So you could then tell from the word order what the subject and the object are. So the simplification of the word endings led to a complexification of the syntactic system in that case.
One of the things you were finished.
And there's one other neat thing. This is disputed, but it's popular to talk about right now. It's been claimed that if you have a very tiny population that's isolated, like Caucasian groups in the Caucasus Mountains near where the Winter Olympics were, that they end up getting more and more complex. So some of the most complex languages in the world in terms of their pronunciation and syntax are Georgian, and Abkhaz in that area.
Why?
When you have a massive language spread over a large, large area like English, it tends in this theory to simplify more.
Mm.
So it's not that all languages simplify. In this theory, it's claimed that it depends on how isolated you are and how large your group is.
What is the hardest language in the world to learn universally?
That's all relative to what languages you already know.
That makes sense.
For a kid who knows no language at all, it looks like all languages are equally easy to learn. Whereas if you already know Chinese, it's easier to learn a language in the Chinese family than it is to learn English.
What would be a language in the Chinese family? Mongolian?
Family they belong to is called Sino-Tibetan. So that would include, obviously, the varieties of Tibetan, like Amdo and Lhasa and Gelsumdo and so on. But I think it also includes languages like Nashi, the language that still has a pick writing system in the south of
China. Nashi.
Yeah, but also,
I'm a fluent Nashiist.
A Nashist.
I love that esoteric stuff.
But also things like Cantonese and Shanghainese and things like that.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So any language, if you're just starting at a neutral point, is as easy to learn as you just, obviously, because kids learn at the same rate no matter what it is.
Yeah, that seems to be the case. It's never been systematically looked into, but from what we see, it seems to be true.
Is there a language I guess it all depends again on your exposure to. If you're an English speaker,
mm-hmm.
what's the easiest language? It might be French, just because so many French words
probably,
are English.
Or Dutch.
Right?
Oh, yeah. The shared vocabulary would make French easier. Spanish also has a massive shared vocabulary with English, which would help. German and Dutch and so on, because they're historically very close to English.
I didn't know that. I didn't know German. I think someone like George Bernard Shaw said life is too short to learn German. Right? I mean, it seemed, I heard that's a very difficult
language.
Well,
people just, in general, people don't like the case endings of German. That's what they really have a problem with.
What does that mean?
Well, Bert will explain much better than I will.
Let the
Germans
Harvard
endings on their words to mark the role of a word in a sentence. So, like, if you want to use mark possession, you would put a genitive case ending on. We actually still have that in English. So, John's book, not John book.
Oh, okay.
But they also have endings like that S there for if you're saying to John or with John and things like that, whereas we don't bother with those anymore.
We, as Bert was saying earlier, we mark the function of what a word does in a sentence by its position, right? So you say something like, you know, I bought the cat, right? And so you know that what you are buying is marked by the fact that cat comes after bought. Right, so the word order does it rather than in German, you would do it by marking it with putting some sort of ending on the end of the word. And in, you know, languages like Latin, for example, there are even more case endings. And so then it doesn't even really matter what order you put the words in.
Wow.
You can say the same sentence with the same three words and put them in different orders. And what you achieve by that is having different emphasis.
What can you trace back the origins of certain words like, for example, fuck? Pussy, son of a bitch, cocksucker,
cunt,
cock, cunt. What are all these words? Where'd they come from? I would imagine they came from England because they use cunt in England constantly for, you know, pass the salt. You know, I mean, it's, you know, but where did fuck start? Because I heard, if I could, if I may, that it was fornication under consent of the king. And and apparently sailors were allowed to have sex with hookers, you know, based on that. I think hooker comes from the Civil War general, Hooker, who liked his ladies. So I don't know. You tell me.
There are lots of these folk etymologies for taboo terms. A folk etymology is one that's been made up by a non-linguist. And they tend to actually be acronyms. Like for unlawful carnal knowledge for fuck or cunt, see you next Tuesday sort of thing. But they don't seem to actually come from those sources. It can be very hard to tell because for obvious reasons, taboo words like fuck don't show up in print very often.
Right.
So if you're looking in old manuscripts to trace the development of a word, those kinds of things don't normally show up. And, actually, the earliest attestation of fuck in English is in a manuscript from here in Cambridge that was it was a little song making fun of the monks who used to be in where Queen's College is now, right next to King's, where I am. And it says in it, the friars of this monastery aren't in heaven because they fuck the wives of Ely, which is a town just up the river from here.
Good to be a monk.
But it's not only that, I mean, just in terms of how, because Bert actually showed me the original manuscript, and it's not just that the word fuck is in there. They put the word fuck in code because they didn't want to write the word fuck.
Wow.
Yeah.
Wow. And but yet we don't really know. Maybe it just sounded, people, I mean, was it sounded like somebody made the word up, right? I mean, sometimes you can make a word. Shakespeare made up a lot of words, didn't he?
Yeah, so it seems. Yeah. That word, there seem to be cognates in German and Dutch, which are closely related to English. But as far as I know, we can't go any earlier than that.
When was fuck used? I mean, it's used a lot nowadays, but it used to be very taboo. I mean, when was my mother said to me, and I think it's just she's just so naive. I never even heard the word until way later. And I was like, all right. I saw it written on a wall. Like, what? What are you talking about? But in the 40s, in the 50s, in this country, wasn't it used a lot among, you know, working class people?
That's hard to prove because we don't have all that many recordings of that time and it didn't show up in print very often.
Yeah.
But did you see about the letter that was just discovered this past week from a British woman who talked about how in when they I think they were celebrating the Victory in Europe Day outside of Buckingham Palace. Lots of couples were screwing out in front of Buckingham Palace.
Really?
Yeah, that's something you don't see written in print, but in this letter it says that that's what they were all doing when this wow. woman was there. Yeah.
Wow. I don't believe her. Drunk.
So it is hard to document the sort of thing you're asking about, so I don't yeah. really know for sure.
I guess there are just so many different words. I'm just trying to think of the words we use a lot. What about cock?
I think cock is from cockerel, a term for a male chicken, effectively.
Yeah.
And I'm not sure where the connections come from there, but with taboo concepts like penis and vagina and so on, avoidance terms tend to get made up. So, for
right.
example,
your hoo-hoo, yeah.
Toilet means little towel, literally. It's taken from French, and it's used to stand for something that it's hard to know what the real word is yeah. for it, actually. All the things I can think of, like bathroom, toilet, John, Lou, none of them are the actual thing. They're all replacement words. Mm. And both rooster, which you think, if you think about it, is something that roosts on a beam in a barn. That's an avoidance term for a cockerel, presumably because it had by that time come to be used as an avoidance term for the penis.
Wow. Well, yeah. It's always about it.
Yeah.
Being polite.
And I think that's what's so fascinating about language is that the more you start to dig into it and look into it, you realize that, you know, in plain sight, human psychology is writ large. You know, it's really right. about, like, you know, our desire for identity, separateness, the desire to be yeah. like cool people and unlike our parents.
Well, it's also a violent, you know, I always was talking about, I learned very early on that because I had a gay acting teacher who was explaining what it's like, you know, but I remember this in 1991, 92. He said, you know, the word faggot is an acceptable prejudice. Making fun of gay people is an acceptable prejudice. It's no longer acceptable to make fun of black people or whatever. He was using an example, but he said, you know, and I remember it. I remember it, you know, you could still on TV or you were a stand-up comic or, you know, I never liked doing it because I didn't want to make anybody feel bad. It just didn't make any sense to me. But very recently, up until very recently, that word, and you know, faggot was now, if you use it in certain circles, you know, it's very, very offensive to people. And I get that because I've always said that the reason you shouldn't use words, the reason nigger or faggot or words like that are so loaded is because they were used usually by a mob or by somebody who was trying to kill you or hurt you or do something bad to you. So when those words have been used by bigots and violent bigots often to keep you in your place or to keep you down or to kill you, boy, you're going to have memory of that. You know, if you're a member of that group or you love somebody who's a member of that group or you just a human being who knows what that's about, you're gonna find offense. You're gonna, you know, that's part of why you need to educate yourself on how language was used and why it's used, right? Can you talk a little bit about those two words and specifically?
Yeah, that's a really interesting theory you have there, Brian.
I hope there's some truth to it. I don't know.
Another element that factors into that is the political power that the group being targeted has. And you can see that in, for example, the terms for when you wash yourself off out of a sink rather than taking a bath or a shower.
Mm-hmm.
So what do you call that?
Well, a sponge bath.
Oh, that's a very politically correct term.
Douche, is that what you're talking about?
No.
Oh.
There are lots and lots of regional variations for this, which tend to involve an ethnicity that's stigmatized in that area, like Mexican shower, Polish shower.
Oh, yeah.
That kind of thing.
Yeah.
And you can see pretty quickly the role of the political power of the groups being targeted when you consider which groups you can't plug into that label.
Mm-hmm.
So you don't see Jewish shower or, I can't even go into the ones that aren't allowed because you can.
Yeah.
But if you think about it, they're all equally offensive. but some of them you can't say and some you still can.
Yeah.
Well, and that's, I remember when you told me back in college the difference between a dialect and a language is an army.
Yeah.
Which I thought was so fascinating. And you, and
it, wow.
Yeah.
Oh, that's very interesting. I never even thought of that.
And as you start to look around you again and again, I mean, you know, from a purely linguistic point of view, you know, things like Spanish and Italian and French and all that sort of stuff aren't that different. You know what I mean? But they have, or, you know, Spanish and Catalan are, you know, not that different, you know. But the difference is that the Catalonians don't have an army yet. And so, you know, they end up not being a country and they're not, you know, and their people try and claim that it's, you know, whatever, whatever, whatever. But I mean, yeah, there's, I mean, here are huge, huge, huge amounts of politics around this. Actually, the one that's really topical and interesting is Russian and Ukrainian.
Yeah, yeah. And that's doubly topical because I think of that dialect language divide as directly analogous to what's happening in the Crimea right now versus what happened in Karabakh in 1991. So inside,
help us with what happened in Karabakh in 1991.
So inside Azerbaijan, one of the old republics in the Soviet Union, there's this area called Karabakh, which historically was entirely Armenian, but Stalin gave it away to the Turkic component of the country in the 20s. And they voted when the Soviet Union started falling apart to rejoin Armenia. And since the population was roughly 95% Armenian, the referendum went through in favor of rejoining Armenia. But then the Azeri government sent in the tanks and the U.S. didn't do anything and neither did Russia. And so a war began and ultimately Karabakh remained in Azerbaijan. Whereas the exact same thing just happened in the Crimea, where the local people voted to join Russia and nothing's been done. The Russians came in and now it's part of Russia for the moment. Mm-hmm. And the difference is having an army and a navy in part.
Well, but how different is Ukrainian from Russian?
There used to be a continuum of Slavic varieties between Ukrainian and Russian and something called Ruthenian that was spoken in this area around the Crimea. And now, a few hundred years later, after the Ukraine and Russia became separate political entities, there are a few more differences. But everyone I've known who spoke Ukrainian also understood Russian. So, and from a linguist perspective, they're extremely similar.
And, that's in general the test for whether something is a language or a dialect. If two people can understand each other, then it's a language.
I'm surprised then that Ukraine would actually cede, want their independence. I know they already did, but I mean, I'm surprised that the Ukraine would say to the Kremlin or Russia proper, thanks, but no thanks. Now we want to form our own country. That's interesting to me, since they speak the same language. And I would imagine, I know a little bit.
Well, you say they speak the same language. There are a lot of Ukrainians who are very clear on the fact that it's not. And there's also even politics within Russian about it. I remember my Russian teacher was talking about there's like two prepositions for on or at in Russia. One is used for countries and one is used for provinces. Mm. And so the Ukrainians would always insist upon using the one that marked Ukraine as a separate country, and the Russians would use the one that marked it as a province.
And so it goes, ladies and gentlemen, and so it goes. Human beings are tribal.
Yep.
It's amazing.
Yeah.
That's glaringly obvious, I guess, when you're a linguist.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And that's another reason I was drawn to linguistics is language is arguably the main marker of human individual and group dynamics. There's also fashion and music choice and things like that, but those are a little bit harder to study, at least using online surveys like I do.
Is language evolving very, very quickly now with the internet? I mean, we're sharing words, aren't we? We're sharing all kinds of things.
The available evidence suggests that languages evolve at a fairly consistent rate. There are a few things that can affect that. Again, this is disputed, but invasions, for example, seem to trigger waves of rapid, rapid development. So after the Norman French invaded England English started to change very rapidly.
Mm. Yeah, I think 60% of all words in English are derived from the French. So liberté, liberty, you know, all those different, I mean, it keeps going on and on. I mean,
yeah, and it changed very quickly after the Normans arrived. And if you contrast that with Iceland or the Faroe Islands, where there were Germanic speakers living for thousands of years completely in isolation, basically, short of a few trade contacts. Icelandic, for example, isn't all that much different now than it was in the Old Norse period of the sagas.
Wow.
They still speak Viking, basically.
Why did Latin go away?
In one sense, Latin never went away. French and Spanish and so on are Latin. They just have different names now, and they wouldn't be intelligible to speakers of Latin in 500 BC. But basically, over that period of time, any language is going to change to the point where you can't understand the form spoken 2,000 years ago. But the reason for the name change is basically that the political entity of the Roman Empire fell apart.
And also, generally, the Latin that we see in, you know, Virgil or Cicero or any of these like famous Roman writers is the highest form of Latin, like the most prestigious, most educated. And a lot of the Romance languages that we have today, like Italian and French, they really derived from the street Latin, right?
Yes, yes. And also, there technically are some languages today that are still called Latin. For example, Ladino, which is a variety of Spanish spoken by the Jewish communities that lived in the south of Spain during the Moorish period.
The Jews spoke Hebrew. The ancient language was Hebrew. When they were in Europe, it was Yiddish. Which sounds to me like a pigeon form of, all due respect to anybody who speaks Yiddish, a pigeon form of German. But then they sort of refound Hebrew when they found the state of Israel, right? I mean, there was this movement, and a very successful one, to essentially revive an ancient language. Is that true?
Yeah, exactly. So technically, Yiddish is a Germanic language that's very, very closely related to German. And it has a lot of Hebrew words in it. Mm. And then when the state of Israel was created, there had already been a Zionist movement before then that had as one of its points of interest keeping Hebrew alive and spreading it again, making it a living language in the usual sense. And that movement took on a lot of steam once the state of Israel was created. And there were lots of varieties of Hebrew floating around at that time in North Africa, where the Sephardic Jews were around in large numbers, in Western Europe, where the Ashkenazic Jews were. And the varieties spoken by the Ashkenazic Jews won out by and large. And that's why, for example, if you look at Hebrew today in Israel, they pronounce R the way a French or a German speaker.
Oh, wow.
Ah, yes, it's gorgeous for you when you speak to someone from Israel. Sometimes they talk like, it's almost like they are from France. You know, it's bad yeah. French accents.
That sums it up. That was brought over by the Jews from France and Germany. Whereas the ones...
I always wondered, because then you have some Israelis who speak more like they're from, you know, Lebanon.
Exactly. That's it.
Bert, we should really, really talk about the Harvard Dialect Survey, and as a way to segue into that, could you tell our listeners about the origins of shibboleths and what a shibboleth is?
Okay, shibboleth is a Hebrew word, and it shows up in the Old Testament in this story about two tribes that were fighting each other, and the Gileadites and the Ephraimites. And one group found out or had reason to suspect that there was a spy from the other group in their camp. Mm-hmm. And both of these groups spoke Hebrew, but in one dialect, the word shibboleth for an ear of corn maybe was pronounced shibboleth, and then the other was pronounced sibboleth. So they brought...
Because one guy had a lisp.
They lined up everyone in the camp and had them pronounce this word. And when one of them said Sibboleth, they killed him.
Wow.
But that's the power of like those subtle variations that allow you to tell where
sure.
someone is from. I mean,
they did that in World War II when would yeah. say, you know, somebody was a spy and they would ask them.
Well, the Dutch resistance famously did that. There's this town yeah. in Holland called Scheveningen. And of course, because German and Dutch are so close, like German spies were able to learn Dutch to a pretty high degree of accuracy. And what they would do is that periodically they would just go through and they would have everybody in the resistance group say this word, and then they would shoot anyone who couldn't say
Damn.
It because they were a German.
Damn. So
the Harvard Dialect Survey.
Yeah. So now we use Shibboleth to refer to a subtle feature that gives someone away as belonging to a particular group, even if they're trying to hide it. And this is basically what Sherlock Holmes was interested in when he studied types of cigarette ash and patterns of wear on people's shoes and so on. Very subtle tells that give away someone's social class and things like that.
Yeah.
And so I started developing techniques like that when I was teaching dialects of English at Harvard in the 90s, because all the students at Harvard, by and large, would just speak some kind of American English. You couldn't really tell easily where they were from unless they were Canadian.
Yeah. Or
The New York accent is still socially allowed at Harvard, so they typically wouldn't get rid of their accent. But people from the Midwest would normally have to wipe out their accent within a week of coming.
Wow.
So I started working on finding shibboleths that would give away where someone's from, even when they're speaking standard English. And that's how that survey developed.
And that's how you busted me. I remember the first time that I ever met Bert, I was having a conversation with him. And then I'm like talking and talking and thinking we're having a conversation, but Bert is really like watching what I'm saying. And all of a sudden he stops me and he says, if John and Jane are in a race and John comes in fifth and Jane comes in after John, what position does she come in? And I was like, sixth? And he's like, ah, British. And that's the point is that even though for
you... Why'd you say sick? Sixth?
Sixth. That's how a British person says sixth. And
sixth.
So it's the sort of feature where...
Sixth.
I didn't even realize that. Like, I worked very hard to have an American accent.
Oh, right.
But there are these, like, tiny words that you don't even realize. Or the other one was the difference between medicine and medicine.
Yeah, you
British
say medicine.
Medicine and
yeah, you definitely have. I hear it.
There are those tiny, tiny features, but that's what this
you
survey.
You say vitamin too.
Well, not vitamin, vitamin.
Oh yeah, vitamin. Like whatever, traitor. I didn't know we had an Al Qaeda plant over here. This fucking Al Qaeda plant guy.
But so that's what this survey is. Like this survey is how many questions is it, Bert?
122, the original one was.
Yeah, 122 questions with all these things, and they basically test where you're from, and from that, Bert is able to figure out where you are from.
That's
so actually,
awesome.
It might the classic like New York test might be a good one to do on Brian to see whether he's really, really from New York.
Go ahead. Go ahead.
So if you're going to get tickets for a movie, you might stand...
In line?
Uh-oh.
What?
Do you know what New Yorkers would tend to say there?
I don't think they'd say queue.
Online. Stand online.
I stand online, yeah.
Brian, I'm sorry, you're not a New Yorker.
Damn it! Damn it! I want to be edgy so badly.
But see, that's the sort of thing where even
online,
if you fake the New York accent, you know, you don't know to fake those things, and
there
that's
you
how
go.
You mark yourself
I
as
love
not
it.
A New Yorker.
Yes.
Another good one is, you know how in a hardcore New York accent... It's non-rhotic, so you only pronounce R's if they're before a vowel. So you'd say, you know, ca instead of car, for example. But even New Yorkers who don't do that will pronounce the word forward in a different way typically. How would you say that word?
Forward.
Oh, you don't have it. Again.
Hold on.
Forward.
I'd imagine.
Those are both in a New York accent, but even New Yorkers who don't have a New York accent will tend to say forward without
forward,
the first.
Forward. Yeah.
Forward.
What about drawer? Some of them say draw.
Draw. So that's typical in Black English in the United States or African American vernacular English, as it's called.
Yeah.
but also in lots of Southern varieties of English and in the Boston and New York types of English. Some people still have that.
Well, you know, my roommate in high school was from the Bronx and he was black, and he would say axe instead of ask. And he knew the difference. A lot of it was just more of a fuck you. And more of it was like, you know what, man, I'm going to say axe because I know it's wrong, and go fuck yourself. Like,
well, but that's the point. It's not wrong. He's saying, like, I'm a part of this group and not a part of your group.
Well, yeah, it's a little bit more like, you know, I'm going to hold on to whatever my childhood was or whatever.
Yeah.
And it is wrong.
Axe is actually the older form. And both axe and ask have been around in varieties of English for more than 1,000 years.
They both
show Old English long before the slave trade began and so on. So basically every single feature you find in Black English in the U.S., you can find in different dialects in the United Kingdom. So it's basically a conglomeration of dialect features that were floating around the South in the 17th century and on.
That's very interesting.
And what makes things seem wrong to people, in quotes, is if they're associated with the Black community or any other stigmatized community. It's not whether they're historically older or more or less logical. It's always whether a stigmatized group uses them or not.
So what he's saying is, Brian, is you're racist.
Now I finally figured out.
You're a non-New Yorker.
Damn
and
it.
You're a racist.
And you're a racist son of a bitch. One of the things that I watched Ken Burns' documentary on jazz, and jazz had its own language, of course. Even the language that evolved around jazz, the Black, it's really a marriage between the African and the European. You know, I mean, it's a biracial expression, but it's probably our highest American art form. At least that's what a lot of people would say. And it is primarily an African American. You know, they've probably contributed more so than have other, you know, than probably white people. I would imagine that could be disputed. I'm not a jazz historian, and I know there've been great jazz musicians. So let's just leave that, and I don't even want to touch that. But
tried to develop a form of jazz called white jazz. Did you know that?
I did not know that. I didn't know that. But thank God for the Black jazz. Thank God for the African. Thank God for the rhythmic tradition that came from Africa and then was married to the melodic tradition of the Europeans. Because, you know, that's what I think, that's sort of that's the roots not only of jazz, but of the blues and certainly of rock and roll. The black expression in this country, Black people in this country.
Brian, are you just trying to backpedal from your racism?
No, not at all.
Is that what's really going on here?
They definitely have their own language. And it feels, and correct me if I'm wrong, feels like Black people in the South and Black people in the North are more closely, sound closer, are not as different as, say, somebody who's white from Alabama and somebody who's white from New England. Is that true or am I wrong?
I would say that's definitely true. That's actually a forbidden question.
Whatever, not on this show. I can't stand politically correct bullshit because it's all about, let's not tell the truth. Oh, no, I don't give a shit. I'm a comic. I can say whatever the fuck I want, always will. I'm not, because you know what? I'm not prejudiced. That's the difference. I'm not racist. I'll say whatever the fuck I want and know that, you know, I know you're an academic, so you got to be so careful because you really can't have a real fucking honest conversation. That's the truth about academia. Talk about the language Nazis. I mean, it's so difficult for someone like you. I'm sure I know how it is, and you know, my God, you're attacking me with your microaggressions. Go fuck yourself. This is the real world we're living in. I'm a comic. One of the great things about being a comic is I can say what I want, how, when. And I've never gotten in trouble because I'm not prejudiced. I've never gotten in trouble because guess what? I ain't a bigot and I ain't racist. I just like telling the truth. And you know who's not offended by that? Black people. You know who is? White liberals. All right? So anyway, let's keep going.
They're very, you're quite right, I would say, based on my study of them. So the varieties of African-American vernacular English, as it's called, across the U.S., are basically Southern American varieties. So, for example, the pronoun you use to address a group of people is y'all.
Mm-hmm.
in both Black Englishes across the U.S. by and large, and in Southern white Englishes. And they also both have the pin-pen merger, as we call it. So pin and pen get pronounced the same in most Black Englishes and in most white Southern Englishes. You say pin for both, or pin. Yep.
Like, yep. Can you pass me a pin?
A pin.
Yeah.
And that makes sense, because there was the majority of Black people that came, they migrated to the North from the South.
Yeah, it's pretty obvious if you think about it.
Yeah. All right.
And that's the other fascinating thing, too, is that, you know, like what Bert was saying with American dialects, right? So, you know, Southern American English is really descended from Cornwall. You know, Northern American English dialects are descended from London. What you're seeing with all of this stuff is you're really seeing the movements of people, and it's written on everything. Like, Australian English has strong Cockney features. Isn't that right, Bert?
Yes, definitely.
Yeah. That's what's so fascinating is that, you know, you can actually, and ultimately some of the sort of the historical linguistics work is about figuring out the movements of people from the languages that are spoken today. Like, you can tell who invaded who got kicked out of where, and so on and so forth.
Mm-hmm.
Deconstructing language. Tim Ferriss, we've had on this podcast, who wrote a number of good books, fun books, The 4-Hour Body, The 4-Hour Work Week, and stuff. And he's one of his passions is language. And he was talking about you can learn a language because if you understand and if you know what to study, most of the words in a language are not spoken. So in Spanish, he says you can learn 2.5% of the words in the Spanish dictionary and understand 90% of Spanish. Mm. Is that the case with most languages?
Yeah, I would say it is. There's an inverse relationship between the frequency of a word and, well, that didn't go well. The most frequent, say, 1,000 words in a language are almost all of what you use on a daily basis. It's only people in pretentious contexts, like a university lecturer writing a scientific article, who would use the other words. And interestingly, in a language like English, all those most frequent words, the key ones to interacting with people, are still native Germanic words. They're not the French words.
Give me the best way to learn a language. Right now I'm listening to Michel Thomas and his tapes. And Michel Thomas doesn't let you memorize anything or write anything down. He just teaches you the verb structure, and then he just basically brings you through the language. It still takes a while. Let's not You can learn French in a weekend. No, you can't, Michel. I know you're dead now, but no, you fucking can't. So what's the best way to learn a language?
The best way is to be a kid under 6 years old and to just hear actual humans speaking the language around you. Schooling doesn't work very well for language. That's one of the disasters in your average human society, that we need to be under six and learning it just by hearing it. Whereas the way people think it works is you have to be over six and learning it in school, which is the worst way to do it.
Wow. So
it's been found in some recent studies that kids learn very effectively by interacting with people who speak their language, but they don't learn by listening to TV or radio or tape recordings or things like that.
Right.
So basically, hang out with people. Like, all of this stuff comes down to interacting with people rather than interacting with tapes or CDs. Like, the tapes or CDs might give you some sort of framework, but ultimately what's really going to instill it is actual conversations with actual human beings.
Mm. Yeah. And the younger you are, the better.
Yeah, well, what if you have to do some CIA work and you got to learn Farsi really quickly? And I can't get into a time machine and become six, Bert. I'm talking about as an adult. What's the best way to do it?
Well, it looks like social constraints and fears and things like that play a large role in inhibiting people from acquiring some of the key features of a language. So, what plays the largest role in native speakers' assessment of how well you speak is your accent, rather than the order you put words in or how fancy the words you know are. And getting the accent runs afoul of ideas we have about who we are. So, for example, let's say you're a high school student and you're in Spanish class if you tried to speak like an actual Mexican or Spaniard, you get made fun of and ridiculed by your classmates. So the boys in particular would tend to just pronounce the words, but in an American way, which will end up being a total failure if you go to Spain or Mexico.
Right.
So one thing to do is try to override your social inhibitions, which is quite hard, but probably less hard for you as a comedian.
But I mean, and that's the thing. So much of this is about social inhibition. Like that's what gets in the way of people learning languages is it's a question of identity. When you're learning another language, you're being asked to join another group that you may not like, you may not respect. I mean, if you look at, for example, you know, my dad's Dutch, right? And, you know, the Dutch learn many, many, many languages. And consistently, the language they always speak worst is the one that's closest to their own, German.
Wow.
They don't want to learn German because they don't want to identify as Germans or have any association with German for fairly obvious historical reasons. You find the same thing with Poles. Like, Poles were made to learn, Eastern Europeans were made to learn Russian under the Soviet occupation. And even though, again, their languages are very, very close, they were always terrible at it because they didn't want to belong to that group.
Wow. Well, there you go. Well, Bert Vaux, I can't thank you enough, man. This has been pretty fascinating.
Yeah.
Once again.
That's fun, Brian.
Yeah, thanks. And, you know, if I'm ever doing stand-up in Cambridge or I will be in Boston probably in about 6 months. How often are you in Boston? Are you still at Harvard?
Nope, I'm in England.
He's at the other Cambridge University,
yes, of
the
course.
Older Cambridge, the first Cambridge.
Why haven't you? See, if I worked at Cambridge, I wouldn't really have an English accent, but I'd speak this way. I think somehow I'd end my sentences with yes. So, Bert, would you like to grab beer? Would you like to grab a pint? Yes. It just sounds really aristocratic. Well, of course, we have a boat, yes, and I wouldn't own a boat. I would just have pictures of a boat on my wall. Well, that's my boat, actually. It's my boat in California, yes. Does anybody do that, or am I the only one who ends their sentence?
Is used as a tag marker here in, not in posh British English, but in more working class variety.
Yes, well, I would be a lot more posh. You couldn't really prove where I was from in England.
Actually, that's a good one in terms of folk etymologies. People often say that posh stands for port out starboard home, as in like that was the best way to travel when you were on a cruise liner.
Yeah.
Is that true or no?
I don't know.
Yeah. Hard to that's trace suspicious. These things.
Yeah.
Bert Vaux, thank you very much for and continue to teach the world. Continue to tear down that Tower of Babel, sir.
And just for the record, Bert's Harvard dialect survey was actually featured by the New York Times and has now become hugely viral. And I will make sure in the episode description to include that so you guys can find out what shibboleths you use that you don't realize that you use. And,
there
you know,
it is. He's 6'6". He played 2 sports in college. He speaks 50 languages badly.
And he's a rock guitarist.
And he's a rock guitarist, ladies and gentlemen. Bert Vaux, you're a good man, sir. Thank you.
Thanks.
We appreciate it. Go back to teaching your children.
Thank you, Bert.
See you, buddy.
Bye.
Bye. Good guy. A good man. Ladies and gentlemen, go to briancallen.com if you want to find out where I'm doing stand-up comedy. You'll learn nothing, but you'll laugh. Hunter, thanks for getting this guy. He's a good man.
Yeah, Bert's awesome. Bert's awesome.
Yeah.
And it just, I mean, that's the thing. I mean, once you start to realize that language and dialect are identity, it's how you mark your tribe.
Yeah.
It does give you a really new perspective on the world because you realize that when people are having a certain accent, they're doing much, much more than just speaking the way their parents spoke. They're making a choice about who they belong with and who they don't belong with.
Yeah, that was a learning experience. Every time we have a conversation with one of these guys, I learn. I hope people feel the same way. At least we're talking. All right. Thanks, ladies and gentlemen.
You've been listening to The Brian Callen Show with Brian Callen. Be sure to like him on Facebook. Just search for Brian Callen Comedy. And follow him on Twitter. Just search for @BrianCallen. You can also find him online by visiting his website. Just go to briancallen.com. Until next time, bye-bye.